I should probably say as a preface, as a creative writing student, PhD student, we have to write both a critical and a creative body of work. So this is kind of one of my experiments with sort of trying to get those two discourses speaking to each other. And how do you go about being critical as a creative writer? It's 1898. We stand in an art gallery, perhaps London, perhaps elsewhere. These spaces begin to blur. Gilt gold against vermilion, heavy curtains muted by sun, air slightly stale. There is the sense that you'd only have to pick the right door, step into any gallery in Europe. I elbow you in the ribs and nod at two women across the room. It's day that we have come to see. Their backs are turned to us, but the woman on the left seems to sense that she is watched and glances back just long enough to reveal a prominent nose and a long face. Author, Vernon Lee, I whisper. Real name, Violet Page. The other woman is too absorbed in the painting to notice. She's an artist. Clementina Arisferia Thompson, kit to friends. I nod meaningly as Lee brushes her on. They are lovers, or so the story goes. They're not here for pleasure, however, but science. Lee keeps correspondence with the prominent German psychologist, Theodore Lips, who has introduced her to the idea of Einflung, which has recently been translated in English to empathy. Theodore Lips uses this idea in his Psychology of Aesthetics, suggests that observers project themselves into work of art through their body's unconscious mimicry of form. He's later to use the same idea as a pathway for interjective feeling, in which the observer inwardly imitates the movements of another. I feel myself so inside of him, Lips writes upon watching a tightrope walker. The two women, however, are mainly interested in it as a theory of aesthetics. It's to test this theory that they have been visiting art galleries all across the continent. And it's working, for Ansara Thompson at least. When she looks at a painting, she experiences changes in her breath, balance and muscular tension. Lee records these responses, though she remains uncertain of her own. We edge forward to see that Ansara Thompson has laid a hand against her stomach. Only the slightest lines of scepticism lining to Lee's eyes. For now, however, Lee is passionate about the idea, and even suspects a close relationship between embodied empathy and language. In 1894, she wrote that their arrangement of words, which, by opening up vistas or closing them, make the reader's mind broader, hurry or labour busily along. And later on, she used to state that empathy is what explains why we employ figures of speech at all. Empathy, therefore, has been inexplicably intertwined with embodiment and art from its very conception. Unfortunately, the intertwining of Lee and Ansara Thompson is not so strong. Years pass, and Lee is still unable to experience any kind of aesthetic bodily response. This is not perhaps a failing on Lee's part. As the phenomenologist Leather writes, my being in the world depends on my body's self-effacing. The body is, in Merleau-Ponty's words, the darkness needed in the theatre to show up the performance. For an act to succeed, the body must disappear from thematised appraisal. Yet in Lee's time, phenomenologists such as Leda and Merleau-Ponty are yet to address the subject of the body. Her trust in Ansara Thompson wanes. Under the rigours of their work, the normally strong Ansara Thompson breaks down. Their disagreements grow and the lovers part. Lee readjusts her thought to give the body a secondary role in a primarily mental account of aesthetics. Ansara Thompson, she says, is just a sensitive motor type. Poor Ansara Thompson. A self-report was in the end not enough to retain the faith of a lover. How can one use words to evoke understanding in the body of a listener when it's the listener's inability to hear their own body that created the need in the first place? To achieve this, we need a different kind of speech, a different kind of eye. We must examine the body for its modality and object in order to return to it as lived experience. 80 years on from Lee's death, it's possible that current neuroscience and philosophy may supply such an eye. And were Lee alive to see through them, might she have never abandoned her lover? We are born into the world as creatures of flesh, and it's through our bodily perceptions, movements, emotions and feelings that meaning becomes possible and takes the form it does. This is Mark Johnson in his 2007 The Meaning of the Body. in which he champions an embodied theory of meaning. Aesthetics, he argues, is not just mimesis, an imperfect copy of the real, but that the process of embodied meaning in the arts are the very same ones that make linguistic meaning possible. For ironically, it's in Lee's own medium of language in which the evidence and the aesthetic bodily involvement has appeared most strongly. To understand why Johnson argues that embodied meaning can encompass even the most abstract conceptual meaning, we need to look at his work in Lacock and Johnson's Philosophy in the Flesh, which argues that people understand complex domains by basing their understanding of them on familiar objects, actions and situations, in this case, the body. Conceptual domains, they argue, map onto body by metaphor, image schemas and prototypes in order to structure human understanding and meaning. To evidence this, they provide a meticulous collection of hundreds of examples of embodied conceptual metaphors. For instance, if an object has gone over one's head, then one hasn't grasped it. This, it would seem, would account for a bodily aesthetic empathetic response in Lee's own craft of writing, has found recent support from the new field of neuroscience called embodied semantics. This branch of neuroscience suggests that reading action sentences activates some motor areas of the brain. In other words, it appears that when one reads about an action, premotor areas of the brain respond as if the reader were carrying out the same action herself. This is not just the case with entirely physical actions such as throwing a ball. Messiah et al. In 2013 compared to sensory motor systems activation in abstract, metaphorical and idiomatic and literal sentences and found that sensory motor systems are employed for all of these, but less so as the abstractness of the language increases. There has also been evidence to support this in a narrative context, suggesting that reader uses their sensory motor system to stimulate and comprehend the action of characters. These theories have already been employed by some literary critics, such as Bolin in 2012, who used the notion of somatotopic CNS involvement to argue that readers spontaneously produce dynamic perceptual stimulation when silently reading text, as an essential and automatic process of story comprehension. Carlico takes this idea even further to argue that stimulation and mental imagery are embodied. They are deeply rooted in our real body. Some passages provide the reader with a fictionally actual body on which to ground his or her virtual body. This virtual body he understands as the counterpart of the real body that a reader sends into fictional worlds. He proposes two types of virtual body the reader can project into. These belong to the characters and that of a narrator. This, I believe, is an important acknowledgement that even third-person omniscient narrators offer descriptions that are implicitly bound to specific embodiments. For to describe something as small or large, hot or cold, near or far, or of a specific colour or hue, is to assume an embodied and often specifically human position. Just as powerful as such in a virtual body is the almost psychosomatic effect reading has on the reader. Physiological responses are always aroused by reading, including racing hearts, sweaty palms, an upset stomach, relaxed muscles, or even sexual arousal. And these responses often correspond to the content of the text. Wollaston et al. In 2011, for instance, have empirically shown that heart rate increases during emotionally intense parts of a story. In the face of such evidence, it seems entirely apt that Byrne and Lee thought of this aesthetic process as empathy, even though the term had yet to take on the exact meaning as it does today, of as in kind of intersubjective being between two people. So the power of art is not just a bodily mimicking, but a feeling into, in which the reader gives characters life within their own body. It's now 2016. What remains of Lee and Arisford Thompson? Their works? Letters? Ideas? Perhaps given Lee's love of ghost stories, a sudden chill on a hot day when stood before an old painting. Gilt gold against meridian, heavy curtains muted by sun, air slightly stale. There is the sense that you'd only have to pick the right door to step back into 1898. There the two lovers still stand, breathing in tune.